I'm excited today to be speaking to Kevin Strauss. Kevin wrote one of my favorite books for environmental education, Tales with Tales, Storytelling the Wonders of the Natural World. The book includes stories that Kevin has written or retold, along with activities that can be used in formal or informal education by teachers, parents, park rangers, and, well, of course, by storytellers. So welcome to the Restoring the Earth podcast, Kevin.
Thank you.
I'm going to jump right into this. I know that your background is in environmental science and natural history, and that you started off in that field. So I'm very curious to know, as an environmental scientist, what got you interested in stories?
Just after college, I was working at some environmental education centers, and we had a training by another storyteller. And I realized after hearing some stories and hearing him talk about his use of stories in teaching people about the natural world that I really liked that aspect. And I liked the science teaching that I was doing, but I also realized that not every child that I was working with was really excited about the natural world. But every kid likes to hear stories. And so I learned very quickly that that was a great bridge, that the door that we can connect with kids with on science is a good-sized door, but the door that helps us connect with kids through stories is a huge door. And so that's what really got me connected. And I realized early on that that I already knew some stories. I had heard some folk tales as a child. I remembered some of those stories, and so I started retelling them the summer I was working at the Environmental Ed Center in Vermont, and then just began learning more and more stories because I realized that was a great bridge between me and audiences, whether they were kid audiences or family audiences or adult audiences.
Great. So why do you think that stories make such a great bridge? In your experience, what is it that stories have to offer? What does that story door do that the science door doesn't?
I think one thing that story doors do is they make a closer, quicker connection with an audience. The science education that I've done can make a connection if folks have background and experience with the topic, whether it's birds or beetles or turtles, but you need some background experience. And stories don't require that because they make a connection right on. And I think our brains are well built for connecting through stories. It's just more natural for us. And so I think that that's a big part of it. Also, stories let us go into our imagination very quickly. A lot of times, science education, there isn't as quick a connection with our brains and our imaginations. And so it takes a couple of steps before folks can start connecting. And a lot of times in doing environmental education and naturalist work, you have some ability to make a connection because you're right at the spot. If you're talking about trees, usually you're in a forest with other trees. And so in that way, you can make a connection to science. But stories work whether you're connected with the natural topic or not. You know, I can do a story in a classroom, and through people's imaginations, they're already going back to the last time they were in a forest, and they're making that connection. And so I think that's a big part of it, is stories work everywhere. Environmental education, naturalist work works best when you're right in the presence of what you're talking about, whether it's a river or a forest or a prairie.
So in a way, almost the stories imaginatively bring us into presence with that place or that animal.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And it also, they also pull up from our memories experiences with that place or that animal, which just science education doesn't always do automatically.
So how do you find or develop stories that do this? Do all stories do this? Are there specific things you're looking for?
Most stories do this. A lot of times personal stories are a great connection when you think back to an experience that you've had with an animal or a plant. Sometimes those are great bridges because it's an experience you've had personally. In terms of folktales, I started out looking at traditional folktales. So Aesop's Fables was a great resource because it's got tons of very short stories about a wide range of animals and plants. And so that was a great resource for me early on. I did look through other, you know, traditional folktales. The Keepers of the Earth book series with Michael Kudo. Michael Kudo, by the way, was the storyteller who came to do the workshop that got me connected. Those are a great resource. There are some other books now out that are nature stories or environmental story topics, and so those have been great. I've noticed that, for me at least, having stories about animals that live in your area are a great connection. And so I began by looking at story collections from temperate areas of the world. So, you know, Western Europe has animals in their stories that are very similar to the animals that you see here in North America. I live in Minnesota in the U.S. And so that was a great resource. And then I discovered something that actually storytellers have been doing for hundreds of years that I didn't realize till a while, is storytellers historically have adapted stories. And so if you look, you know, I was looking at stories from the American South and animals that are in those stories. And then I suddenly realized that those are similar in a lot of ways to stories that you find in, you know, West Africa and in other countries. And so the idea of taking a story theme and shifting the animals a little bit has been something that storytellers have done for hundreds of years. I thought I was being really innovative, and then suddenly I realized, oh no, that's an old tradition. It's already being done. And so that's another thing that I've done, is looked at story themes that I liked and the animals that are used in that story, and then sometimes adapt them for new animals. Because one of the tricky things that I ran into about storytelling about the natural world is there's some debate about who's allowed to tell which stories and what storytelling might be seen as cultural appropriation. And so I began looking at not so much taking existing stories from the Dakota or Ojibwe people and using them, but looking at, you know, are there other stories or themes that come from Europe or other country, other parts of the world that work well for me and that I like. And also I learned early on that at first I thought that if you find any story that has the animal you want to talk about, then that's a great story to learn and tell. And I learned early on that sometimes I don't love those stories, sometimes because of how the story is built or structured or something else about it, it just isn't connecting with me. And so I began looking for stories that I liked early on, and then looking at ways to adapt them for the places and audiences that I was working with. And another experience that I've had is there are some animals for whom we haven't told positive stories. Stories like mosquitoes or bats or snakes, a lot of the stories that exist for those creatures, because of historical and cultural reasons, were not terribly positive. And I realized that I wanted to tell positive stories about a wide range of animals, some of which don't have positive traditional folktales existing. And so I began looking at creating brand new stories. And part of that happened by sort of looking at the folktales that I know and like, and then trying to work backwards to figure out how are those stories created, and then also to build brand new stories. And so that was the work that I've been doing most recently. Now that I've used traditional stories in a lot of ways, I began looking at creating some brand new stories, because a lot of times the animals I wanted to talk about didn't have positive stories in the traditional story world. And so I began looking at creating brand new stories about creatures like snakes, because many of the snake stories you run into, partly because of Western European cultural and history and religion, were tending to be negative stories about snakes. And so I began looking at, you know, how could I create a positive story about a snake that would then help me connect people to the outdoors or the natural world.
So what are the criteria that makes a story an environmental story?
In my mind, a story is an environmental story when it teaches an environmental education concept. So environmental education concepts like the four laws of ecology, you know, everything's connected, everything goes somewhere. There's no such thing as a free lunch, and nature knows best, are one of the concepts that I taught in environmental education programs. Other concepts like, you know, habitat, diversity is the key to stability, those other sorts of education concepts are what I think of when I think of the concepts that naturalists and environmental educators and rangers are using to teach about the natural world. Also, a story can be an environmental story if it teaches us about an animal or a plant in the natural world. So if it teaches something factual about bears or birds or fish, then that can help it fit into to being an environmental story. And the concepts are fairly wide ranging, but if they teach us something factual about the natural world or teach us an environmental ed concept, that's how I categorize environmental stories.
Great, thank you. I want to talk to you a little bit about your book, which I love, by the way, and I've made good use of.
Thank you.
First in Canada and now over here in Scotland. In your book, you include stories as well as games. There's some natural history facts. And there's also some things we might think of as more traditional kind of science lessons, like the science story you were talking about. Things like, I think you have something about exploring avian adaptations and leaf identification. So why is it so important to not just have stories on their own and not just have facts and activities on their own, but to have all of these things brought together in an educational event?
When I started working on Tales with Tales, I realized that I wanted to do two things. I wanted to help naturalists be better storytellers, and I wanted storytellers to be better naturalists, because I was working in both worlds, and I still work somewhat in both worlds. And I realized that most naturalists aren't naturally storytellers. A lot of them come from a science background. They usually have a biology or geology academic background. And in the science world and the environmental education world, we tend to think about facts and science being the important pieces of that world. And they definitely are an important message and language. But I also realized that science doesn't naturally get people to care about things. It's just the way it's structured. It does a wonderful job of helping us understand the science of the world, but it doesn't necessarily help connect with our emotions. Science isn't really meant to be an emotional world. It's meant to be a logical, scientific world. On the other hand, stories connect with our emotions very quickly, early on. But the challenge I ran into with the story end of the world is a lot of my storytelling friends tell phenomenal stories, but often they get the science just a little bit wrong. They talk about butterflies going into a cocoon, and technically they don't go into a cocoon, they go into a chrysalis. And I realized that if you just made a small change with a story, you could get the science right, and you could connect with people's emotions. And so that's why I created the book, is I wanted to help storytellers be better naturalists, and naturalists be better storytellers. And so that's why I wanted to make sure the book had both the stories in it and the science facts, and also some activities to make it easy for the audiences, whether it was a parent or a naturalist or a storyteller, to do all those pieces all at once. And the activities in the book help teach the science pieces and connect with audiences on the science chunks of the material. And then the stories help people connect emotionally with the stories. And I realized that those two things being connected make it even more effective activity and experience than just having a story all by itself or just having a science lesson all by itself.
So can I just ask you a bit, you've touched on this in a couple of your answers about adapting stories. Can you maybe say a bit more about that and maybe provide some tips to someone who is looking to adapt a story for some kind of science education, environmental science, natural history? how might they go about that? And, you know, might there be some things that you need to be careful of? All those sorts of things.
Yeah. When adapting a story, often I'll start with looking for a story that teaches a particular lesson or a particular concept that I want to be working on. And then, let me think of an example of when I've done that. Sometimes if stories automatically have in them animals that are not native to Minnesota here. And so, let's see, one example of that would be when I first discovered that storytellers have been adapting stories for hundreds and hundreds of years. There's a West African folktale about a tug of war between different animals. And in the original story that I found, it had animals that don't live in Minnesota. So there was an elephant and there was a whale. And those are two animals that don't exist in Minnesota. And so I began thinking about, okay, if I wanted to have this, you know, be a story that connects with audiences in Minnesota, you could tell a story as the traditional version from West Africa and use the animals that were there. And that can work just fine, especially if you're telling the story and working in a classroom where you're not, you know, outdoors in the natural world, that can work well. But I wanted to think of a version of that story that could work in an outdoor setting with animals that the audience might be thinking about or seeing right where they are. And so I began thinking about, okay, you know, in the story, the way the animals are operating, there are two very, very strong animals. And then there's a smaller animal that's the trickster, that's trying to trick the other animals in order to win a contest. And so I thought, okay, well, if I was going to adapt and move that story to animals that live in North America, well, we have bears here and we have mooses here. Okay, those are two fairly big animals. One of those could be the land animal that's in the tug of war. And then I try to think of, okay, who's the you know, animal that might be in the water? And I thought, okay, well, bears spend a lot of time on land. Moose spend a fair amount of time in the water. Okay, that setup, biologically speaking, physically speaking, could work to adapt the new story. And so I sort of worked backwards from there to look at the roles the animals were playing in the story and where they were physically, and then sort of rebuilt the story that way. When I'm doing that, I try to make sure as much as I can, that I'm talking about the history of the story too. And so sometimes when I adapt a story, I'll say, well, you know, a version of this story appeared in the West African region, and it was told by this tribal group. And I've adapted it to be, you know, I've adapted the story and changed it a bit to take place here. You know, and so I don't want to just grab a story and then pretend that I made it up originally or that it originally came from Minnesota. And so I want to make sure to talk about the history of that story too, that, you know, this was originally a story from the Ashanti people in West Africa, and I've changed it a bit when it came here to Minnesota. And so that I'm making sure to give credit to all the historical groups that would have told a story like this, rather than just grab it and say, okay, here's my story, and it has to do like this. And that's, I think, one of the important things to keep in mind when you're telling a story. When I tell traditional stories, I always try to talk about, okay, here's a story from Norway, or here's a story from the Ashanti people of West Africa in what's now Nigeria, you know, so that I make sure that the stories have a connection to where they were historically, and that we're giving credit to those cultural groups. When you don't do that piece, I think that's where some challenges can happen, and some discussions about cultural appropriation, is that, you know, you're telling stories from a region and not crediting that group, especially when it's Europeans, you know, grabbing stories from other parts of the world and not giving credit to the cultures and places that those stories come from, just because of the history of how Europeans have interacted with the world has a lot of challenges to it. And so we want to make sure that that's a piece of the storytelling event that you're sharing.
On that note, might it be a good time to ask you, Kevin, to tell us a story?
Sure. One of my favorite stories that I share is one that also helps me think about problem solving, because in my mind, one of the best things that stories do for us, along with helping us connect emotionally with the natural world, is help inspire us to keep on working on problem solving. And this is a story that I created and use a lot, especially at the end of my story programs, because early on as a storyteller, other storytellers that I worked with said that there are different kinds of stories. There's the ha-ha, the funny story. There's the aha story that helps you understand something about the world. A lot of stories that I do are aha stories that help us understand the world. There's an ah sort of story that gives us that emotional connection. And then there's the amen kind of story that is a good closer story that helps you, you know, that helps you understand our place in the world and what we want to be doing to make the world a better place. Now, a long time back, people say there was a kingdom. And even though there was a king, there was no queen. She had passed away earlier, and there was no prince or princess in this land far away. So the king had a problem. You see, he had to decide who was going to be the next king of his land, and he knew that if he didn't choose a successor, there would be civil war, and he didn't want that. And so he was walking back and forth in his throne room, trying to figure out how he was going to solve this problem. And lucky for him, he had helpers. He had a jester there in the kingdom, and the jester said, "You know, my lord, if you want to choose a king, perhaps a test is the thing. Have a contest, and then whoever can solve the contest, well, they'll be the next king. And as long as you make sure that the contest tests the right skills, then whoever wins the contest will also be a good king." The king liked the sound of that, and he thought, "I know, strength. Being a good king is all about being strong." And so he ordered his servants to go up into the mountains and drag a huge boulder down to the center of his castle. Whoever can move that great boulder would be the next king. He sent his pages far and wide with the announcement, and sure enough, before long, many of the great knights and warriors of the kingdom came, but other people came too. Some of the scholars from the great cities came too, and of course, all the regular people, just to see who was going to be the next leader of their land. It created a great festival and music and dancing, and when the day came for the contest, the first people to try to solve the contest were, of course, the nobles, the knights, and the barons. Sir Bedivere came, and he tried to put his great muscles against the rock and move it, but it didn't move an inch. Sir Clarifere, he tried to use a big lever to move the rock, but even that lever snapped and broke. Once all the nobles had tried and failed to move the great rock, then the scholars came. They had pictures and designs and tried to use pulleys and levers, but sure enough, the rock didn't move for them either. And the king began to worry. Maybe the test is too difficult. Maybe no one will be able to solve the problem. After all the nobles and all the scholars had tried their best, a hand went up from the crowd and said, "My king, could I try to solve this problem?" Now, it was a commoner, but the king thought, well, perhaps the commoner has a good solution, and said, "Sure, come forward." And a cloaked figure came out of the crowd. The person walked up to where the king was sitting and pulled back the hood of the cloak, and the king realized who it was. It was someone from his very own city, the stonecutter's daughter. "My lord," she said, "you said we have to move the rock, right? Whoever moves the rock becomes the next ruler?" And the king said, "Yes, that's right." And the woman smiled. She pulled back the cloak, and on her belt she had hammers and chisels. She said, "You know, my lord, you never said you had to move the rock all at the exact same time." And taking a hammer and a chisel, she broke off a chunk of that rock and moved it across the courtyard, and then broke off another chunk and moved that again, until she had moved that entire rock one small piece at a time from one end of the courtyard to the other, and she became the next ruler of that land. And people say that she ruled that land with wisdom and creativity. So keep that in mind the next time you're trying to solve a problem. It often works best to break it into small pieces and move it one piece at a time. And that's the end of the story.
Lovely. Thank you, Kevin. I enjoyed that. So that's a story that you developed yourself.
Right.
Excellent.
Looking at trying to decide a story about solving problems and realizing that especially in environmental problems, they tend to be big and they're hard to solve all at once. But usually, if we can break them into little pieces, it's a lot easier to solve that problem.
Brilliant. Thank you. What tips do you have more generally to people out there who want to use stories in environmental education and maybe are just getting a start in it?
Sure. It's really important to find stories you like more than stories that are about the animals or places that you are physically located right now. So look for stories that you like. It's easier to tell a story you like than a story that you feel like you have to tell. Early on, I was trying to create a story or wanted to use a story in a program about white-tailed deer here in Minnesota. And so I looked through books and found a folk tale about a deer. And I thought, okay, I got the story about the deer. I'm going to go tell the story. And I realized halfway through the story, my audience was not all that excited about the story that I was trying to share. And I wasn't excited either because I didn't really love the story. And so, start by reading lots of stories and looking for stories that you like. And then that will make it easier to tell the story if you enjoy it. Don't always think that you have to tell a story every time you're doing a lesson. Feed them in here and there as you like them. And that can be helpful. But the most important thing I think early on is just read lots and lots of stories, and you'll get a sense for the kind of story that you like, and then it'll sort of fit naturally into the programs. Often I would do working as a naturalist, I would tell a story as kind of an introduction to a program, and if that story also inside of it had an important natural science lesson, then I was able to refer back to that story later in the class and say, remember, in the story about how snake lost its legs. We learned about how, snakes find a way to move themselves around even without having legs like other animals have. Well, here's an example, of what animals are adapted to do in the natural world. And so, as an introduction, stories work really well. Also, they work really, really well as a conclusion. The story that I just told is a great conclusion at the end of the story. Once students have learned about animals in their area and some challenges they're having surviving, that story makes a good conclusion to then talk about, in the story we saw how the stonecutter's daughter solved a problem breaking it apart into one piece at a time. What's something you can think of you can do to help address the challenges that frogs are having in your area?
Great, great tips there. I'm moving towards the end here, unless you had any other tips you want to share. And I ask this of everybody who's in my virtual studio. What gives you hope today?
I think that something gives me hope today about the natural world and the environment we live in is that especially the students that I work with and the young people are excited about the natural world. When I work with folks, they really like learning about animals and plants. And as they learn about animals and plants, they are even more interested in making sure that the animals and plants in their area survive and do well going forward. And so I think the folks I work with and the excitement that I see on their faces about the world gives me hope that moving forward, even though there are challenges out there and it's not going to be an easy task to care for the world that we live in, I see lots of excitement and interest in doing that in the folks that I work with.
Thank you, Kevin. Is there anything coming up that you would like people to know about?
There are a couple of annual conferences here in the United States that, if you're interested in storytelling, they're a great way to connect up with other storytellers and learn about the natural world. One is the Northlands Storytelling Network Conference, and that happens in April in the Midwest part of the US, usually in the state of Wisconsin. And that's a great resource for storytellers, especially in the Midwest. Another great event that COVID has kind of fouled up a lot of our conferences, but they're starting to come back again. But another conference that is a great resource for folks in the US is the National Storytelling Network Conference. And that's been happening in when they had in-person events, it was happening in the state of Missouri. But you can, if you either Google the Northland Storytelling Network or the National Storytelling Network, you can find out about their upcoming conferences.
Great. Thank you, Kevin. And thank you to everybody for tuning in to this episode of the Restoring the Earth podcast. I hope you join me again in a couple weeks when I'll have another interesting guest. Thank you very much.